Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's March 26, 23 degrees and snowing really good here in Old Town Park City. Just had a phone call telling me that the mine road is very dicey. Several people up there without the correct tires and blocking traffic. So if you do need to get to the Silver Lake area, you're going to be better off traveling on Royal Street. Also, looks like we've got an incident crash on 224 near the Bear Hollow and Silver Springs intersection, which could be slowing down traffic as well. So go ahead and slow down because the weather is demanding it. Anyway, on the phone with us with forecast from ABC Forecast Center meteorologist Thomas Keyboy. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Leslie. And yeah, the roads are definitely dicey throughout the Wasatch back. We had a band of lake effect showers kind of get going, and they moved through Davis and northern Salt Lake counties during the early or during the late overnight hours. And then those found their way into the Wasatch back. And that was kind of that first burst of snow that we saw that really blanketed the roadways, really at portions that had completely blanketed I-80 and then over just throughout Park City itself. And we're going to hold on to a pretty good chance for snow showers as we continue through today, because we have the backside of an upper level trough that's going to be working its way through, and now with the moisture in place will lead to a 90% chance of snow showers. It's not going to be one of those situations where we likely see snow all day, but we'll likely see at least multiple rounds of snow throughout Park City. And with the daytime high only coming in around 35 degrees, we'll stick with snow showers through the day and could continue to lead to those dicey conditions out on the roadways. While down in Heber, as we make our way into this afternoon with a high in the low 40s, there's a chance that we could see times of rain and snow. So for today, looking at a pretty good chance for showers outside of any wet weather. You can expect partly to mostly cloudy skies, and it will be breezy at times, and through the daytime hours we could see more additional minor accumulations, maybe on the magnitude of 1 to 2 inches. But of course, anytime you're talking about any accumulations, that could lead to those dicey conditions on the roads. We'll hold on to a pretty decent chance for snow showers into tonight, mainly before midnight, but that chance will gradually dwindle as we go from the overnight hours through the overnight. And by tomorrow morning, we should be on the dry side of things as the overnight low tonight in Park City drops to 20 degrees. The reason why our chance of snow will be going down is because high pressure, thankfully, will actually be building in for our Wednesday. Should actually be a pretty nice day across the state for our Wednesday under a mix of sun and clouds. And will also be a little bit warmer thanks to a little bit more of a southerly flow. We'll be in the upper 30s in Park City tomorrow, while we'll likely see mid 40s in the Heber Valley. Then we'll see mostly cloudy skies on Wednesday night because as quickly as that high pressure moves in, it moves right away. And we're going to go right back into an unsettled pattern as we go from Thursday, Friday into and through the Easter weekend. We're going to have an upper level low pressure set up to our west, and that's going to result in a southwesterly flow for us, and that's going to send energy and moisture through our neighborhood. So each day, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Easter Sunday, will all likely bring better than a 50-50 chance of seeing showers. But the thing is, with that southwesterly flow, our temperatures will also be trending upwards. We'll be in the low 40s on Thursday, middle 40s on Friday. Then we actually could see mid to upper 40s for both Saturday and Sunday, which means during the overnight hours and early morning, it's more likely that we see snow. But during the afternoon, even in Park City, we could see times of rain. So that could lead to some messy situations out there. We'll likely hold on to a pretty decent chance even into early next week before we could calm down by the middle of next week. But all that to say is we have snow showers today, calm tomorrow, and then we're ramping things right back up heading into the Easter weekend, Leslie.
Okay, Thomas, thank you.
You're welcome.
KPCW News Time now, 8:09. And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we have Dave. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, thank you. For today, we're looking at an overall moderate avalanche danger on all aspects at the mid and upper elevations where human-triggered soft slab avalanches are possible. The avalanche danger is low in the lower elevation terrain, and we're recommending that people evaluate the snow and terrain carefully today, as the likelihood of triggering an avalanche will increase with additional precipitation, wind transport, and any hint of March sun that comes out today. Yesterday we had reports of a number of soft slab avalanches in the central part of the Salt Lake forecast region, anywhere from 10 to 18 inches deep. And then we had one avalanche that was an outlier in the Silver Fork drainage that was reported as 2.5 feet deep, 100 feet wide, and running 400 vertical feet. And that avalanche was pretty unique in the fact that it looks like it started as a dry snow avalanche and finished as a wet snow avalanche.
Okay, Dave, thank you.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:11. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott. We'll be taking a look at the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting, as well as some other upcoming items. Park City Public Utilities engineer Lloyd Griffin will be in, along with Ginger Wicks, executive director of the Historic Park City Alliance, be talking about the Main Street Waterline Replacement Project that starts next week. And finally, Park City Community Foundation Equity and Access Manager Jose Chacon and Vice President of Equity and Impact Diego Zagara talking about the merger of two sport and recreation programs into Youth United. Stay tuned. And stay tuned for This Green Earth right after the local news hour. Today's guests include Abraham Lustgarten, who writes about climate change. In his forthcoming book, On the Move, he explores how climate change is uprooting American lives and where people will go. Then a conversation with Alexa Friedman, an environmental epidemiologist who is interested in reducing exposure to harmful chemicals. She'll walk us through a recent study that talks about pesticides and produce. All of that coming up on today's edition of This Green Earth. And of course, you can hear This Green Earth every Tuesday morning between 9 and 10. Taking a look now at some local news, prosecutors have filed new charges against Corey Richens, including attempted murder, for allegedly poisoning her late husband on Valentine's Day 2022. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports prosecutors also claim that Richens was having an affair.
Camas mom of three and realtor Corey Richens is held without bail in Summit County, awaiting trial for aggravated murder. Now she faces new felonies, including attempted murder. Prosecutors say she tried to kill her husband, Eric, on Valentine's Day in 2022. Based on the testimony of a close friend of Eric's, prosecutors claim Corey put fentanyl in a sandwich, quote, from a certain diner in Camas, and left it in Eric's truck with a note. Another friend says Eric called them, saying, quote, I think my wife tried to poison me. That friend told prosecutors Eric broke out in hives. According to the new filing, Eric didn't have food allergies, but opioids can cause allergic reactions. Investigators also found text messages between Eric and Corey around the time of the alleged poisoning. They say Eric sent her a photo, which has been deleted from both of their phones. Prosecutors say Corey told her mother and brother she was the one who picked up the sandwich from the diner. She texted her alleged drug dealer 30 times that day. They track her location via her text to a paramour. They say she texted this person a photo of her GPS showing her location on State Route 32 in Camas, headed to an unknown destination. For more information about the alleged affair and how Corey may have purchased the fentanyl, visit this story at kpcw.org. Prosecutors have dropped the previous three charges of drug possession and added two counts each of drug distribution, mortgage fraud, and insurance fraud Monday. The prosecution believes Corey was in financial distress when Eric died, which would indicate motive. They say she owed lenders about $1.8 million, had a negative bank balance, was being sued by a creditor, and was floating checks. Corey's attorney, Sky Lozaro, says her client continues to maintain her innocence. Lozaro says, quote, there's nothing in the document that affects Corey's approach to defending whatever charges the state levies against her. Third District Court has scheduled a preliminary hearing in the case for May 15th. Corey has been denied bail and will be held for the duration of her trial. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Hey, a reminder that we've had reports about how dicey the mine road is with a number of vehicles not being able to make it up. So if you are headed into the Silver Lake area, you may be advised to use Royal Street. Also, we've had a report of a crash there on 224 near the Silver Springs and Bear Hollow intersection, which is backing up traffic there. Again, if you do have any other road or weather conditions, you can please text them to 435-655-8255. Difficult to answer the phone. Well, the Summit County Council meets tomorrow, starting in work session at 12:50 at the Summit County Courthouse in Colville, to interview applicants for vacancies on the Eastern Summit County Planning Commission. Following that, the council will move into a closed session, and then we'll reopen the work session at about 3:15. In the studio with a meeting preview, I have Summit County Manager Shane Scott. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Happy spring.
Yeah. well, let's first off, how many vacancies do we have on the Eastern Planning Commission?
I think we have two openings, and I think both of those that are coming off or have their term up are both put back in for the commission, and then there's one additional. So three 3 interviews for 2 openings.
Okay, but the terms have already expired, so you just, what, asked them to just continue serving? Because it looked like their terms were done by end of February.
Well, we would love it if people want to continue to serve. I think that's usually their call, and what we usually do is still interview even a reapplicant. So I think that's what's taking place tomorrow.
All right. Then after the closed session, the council will be meeting to discuss the first quarter finances. So how are things looking there?
They're looking good. If you read the staff report, Matt Levitt, who is our finance director, took an approach to really focus on taxes. I think your first quarter report is always your most challenging because we're basically only 2 months into the year with the way that we report things late. So he really did a good job of comparing where we are in basically January and February this year with where we were last year. And I was kind of pleasantly surprised. We've been sort of bracing for a softening, especially in transit room tax. But I think if you look at the local option tax, that was up, I think, almost 5%. I think TRT was up over 7%. So I was pleasantly surprised, and I'm excited for myself and the council to ask him some questions about these numbers.
Okay, because that is a big bounce back then from December that we heard from the chamber where things were all down.
That's right, and we've just kind of been waiting for that and preparing for that to be a little softer than it has been. So, and maybe there's reasons why. Maybe Matt will say, well, there was X, Y, and Z that happened, and that's why. So these numbers can't be relied on to continue to project out for the rest of the year. But at the same time, from what I read in his report, I think we have, it's mostly good news.
All right. You're also looking for one member to serve the unexpired term on the RAP Talks Cultural Committee that is set to expire June 30th of next year. So just one applicant for that?
One applicant for that. I think that one was that, if I'm not mistaken, I think that interview was completed. So this would be the actual appointment to the RAP Tax Board.
Okay, council will also be getting a legislative wrap-up. Anything that you're terribly concerned about?
I wouldn't say concerned. I would say that the session went better than I expected it to. I think the council and staff have done a really wonderful job in the interim between the 2023 session and the 2024 session of fostering good relationships. I think we went into this in a very different manner than we did in 2023. So I think, if you read, Jana Young put together the staff report and has taken really point on our legislative wrap-up. And I think if you read that, you saw that I think we go into there saying, let's minimize the ways we're impacted. And I think we were impacted in a very, very small way. I think we also took the approach to have a couple of goals, and I think we did a good job of those. One of those, for example, was trying to find ways that we can mitigate the effects of tourism in our community, looking for solutions, whether that's through the transient room tax, being able to use some of those funds for mitigation. And there was also, I think it was HB 236 that passed, that's a rural hospital tax that may give us an opportunity to mitigate some of our visitor impacts as well. So that's something I think the council is going to focus on tomorrow and really ask a lot of questions of not only Jana and the staff, but of our representatives from Foxley and Pignelli, who are our lobbyists.
Yeah. So what about that TRT funding law? Was it changed in order for you to be able to use the TRT for tourism impacts?
It wasn't, and we've had some commitments from legislators to look at that in the interim. So I think interim's maybe going to take place in June. I don't know if they've narrowed down the dates for sure yet, but we're going to keep pushing that. And we had some just really good positive conversations. All 5 of my council members were really actively engaged in that conversation. Each one of them went to the capital in different times to talk through why that is so important to us, and adding that third class county designation to be able to spend the TRT in that manner. So I was really surprised at how positive that was received and how far down that road we got. So it was really exciting.
Yeah, as you mentioned, one of the major goals was to build relationships. Do you feel like that was successful?
Absolutely. I think we met some of the legislators that we didn't know before. We had been interacting with a handful, obviously through SB 84 from 2023. That was something that was Summit County was well known in certain legislative circles. I think we were able to increase to build a better relationship with those legislators, and also meet some new ones through some of these other lobbying efforts. So I can't say that we've never had a better relationship with the legislature, but it is so much better than it was last year, in my opinion.
All right. What about the transportation initiatives, the Kimball Junction and I-80 interchange, the STIP funding there?
Yeah, and that too was something we lobbied very hard to get on the STIP. We weren't successful in having that added yet. I think we've kind of come to the conclusion that maybe we were a year early because of the process that UDOT's going through with the EIS there at Kimball Junction. They're still in the comment phase right now, and I think if that was completed, we probably would have had a lot better opportunity to be able to actually get on the STIP. I think right now the legislature is looking at us saying, well, what are we putting on the STIP? We don't even haven't gone through that process of choosing a selection yet. So we're still talking a lot about those different alternatives. As you probably saw, B was thrown out by UDOT, but our staff is putting together B+. We've had lots of members of the community reach out about certain aspects of Kimball Junction and what it might look like. So I think we're going to get a lot more traction. And again, we've had, as we've negotiated and had conversations with legislators, we've had commitments to reassess the Kimball Junction interchange, and not only because of the Olympics, that's another driving force, but also just because it's something that we need today.
And then what about the Silver Summit interchange? This is, of course, over there by the Home Depot area.
We didn't do a lot of lobbying on that. We've really focused on Kimball Junction. I think that's just because we've got the attention of UDOT, also with the Dakota Pacific request for a change in their development agreement. I think it's kind of the topic of the day. But that's another concern we have, absolutely. We put in a temporary light over there. It actually has done a really great job of moving traffic, but that's not a long-term solution. And we're looking at long-term solutions. We're looking at a couple of roundabouts in that area. And then we also wonder out loud, how does MIDA and Mayflower affect that interchange? There's just going to be more and more traffic coming, sweeping in from 80 to 40, and what does that look like? And can we get legislative help on that one as well down the road? So,
yeah. Any additional funding then for the work on 224 and the bus rapid transit lanes?
No funding. But what I understand is the funding that we had received was secure. We've received, I think, $55 million between the feds and the state. So we're actually trying to really refine those costs and see what that's going to be. Every day we don't do those kinds of projects, the costs go up. So. But that's something that the council is going to really need to talk about. And of course, High Valley Transit's having those conversations. And three of our council members, county council members, are on the board of High Valley Transit. So there's some good synergy there between the two organizations.
All right. And I know you're also looking for support for High Valley Transit's Siegel Lilly Transit Campus. So is that what we've named it there, out there on off of US 40?
I don't know if that's an official name, but that's actually how I've had it referred to. So that's when somebody references the Siegel Lilly, that's what they say. But I don't know if that's an official name or not.
Okay. So any additional support for that then?
No, not that I'm aware of. I do try to attend High Valley Transit's board meetings, but I am a little hit and miss on those. So we rely on our three council members on that board, but I'm not sure.
All right. And then there was also a note in the staff report about don't make baseball mistakes for the Olympics. What does that mean?
Don't make baseball mistakes?
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know. Was that in the staff report for our meeting tomorrow?
Yeah.
I missed
that. Yeah, it was
Jana's
report, yeah.
Okay, don't make baseball mistakes for the Olympics. I'm not sure. I do know that some of the feedback we got from some of the legislators was, we're not going to do millions and millions of dollars worth of work for transportation needs, for example, for 3 weeks in 2034. So that's something we've received feedback on, and we're trying to really push. Kimball Junction is the best example of that. That's something that we need now. Well, maybe not now, but we need a fix there, and the Olympics is just going to help facilitate that fix.
Okay. Just had a report of a car crash northbound on 224 there at the canyons. So that's the second report there of some traffic. Again, you're going to need to slow down. Those roads are pretty darn slick. And be careful. Let's see. Wanted to ask you that a tentative date of April 22nd has been set for the Dakota Pacific Real Estate public hearing. You said that you needed to hear from the council and developer if that works. Have you found out at this point? Does it?
We haven't. We are going to talk a little bit about that probably tomorrow, but also I think our next tentative date with Dakota Pacific to come together in an open session is April 4th. And I think after that date, we'll have a very clear path forward. I think Dakota Pacific is just asking for us to have a clear answer when it comes to what is the public actually commenting on. If they're just commenting on Dakota Pacific doing something, that's probably not fair to Dakota Pacific. If they're commenting on 727 units, 500 units, a fix at Kimball Junction, a community benefit, they'd like to know better what exactly they're commenting on, and that's fair, and we want to support that. So if we don't have a clear understanding of what April 22nd looks like and what members of our community are commenting on, we'll probably push that off even further.
Yeah, so has the county seen any additional changes to Dakota Pacific's application, or are they digging in their heels with what they've presented?
Well, I would probably say neither. What we've done the last couple of weeks is we've taken the proposals that we've thrown, the proposals that Dakota Pacific has presented, the proposals that the Summit County Council has presented, and we've run those through an HTRZ model and tried to see what that would look like. Well, how much would that generate in tax revenue that we could spend on a transit center? And I think we're trying to see not how profitable this would be for them, but also like how viable it is. And if we present to them 500 units and that's not a viable solution, which I'm not sure that it is or isn't, we'd like to know that. I think that would help shape the conversation. And I think that's really where we're gonna focus the next couple of weeks.
All right, looking back at Friday's joint meeting between Park City and Summit County Councils, did Park City go ahead and sign on to Summit County's letter to UDOT?
Yes, I believe they have agreed to do so. I think that letter's still batted back and forth. I think I saw something from Alex with Park City even just on Friday. But I think they've agreed to do that and to understand that this is a regional fix that we're trying to look for.
So what's that letter going to say?
I'm not sure exactly. I don't know exactly what the details are, and that's probably what's being batted back and forth. I think there was some concern from the Park City Council, or at least some council members, about what exactly are we signing on to. So I think that's there's still yet to be some of those details are yet to be determined. But I think there's a general consensus that we are supportive. I'm seeing we as Park City, we're supportive of a fix to Kimball Junction.
Yeah, Council Member Roger Armstrong mentioned that adding new alternatives to UDOT's process will just lengthen the amount of time it takes for UDOT to render a decision. So are you jeopardizing but, you know, having an alternative in place for the Olympics and the potential, you know, Dakota Pacific?
We're trying not to, and it's a very a good point, and it's something we're trying not to slow down this process at all. In fact, I think the deadline for these letters is if it's not tomorrow, it's the next day. I think it's coming up this week. So we're trying to really hurry and put together some of our comments, but also not delay this process any further than we have to. And you know, 2034 or 2026, when maybe we might start a solution there. That's still a ways out. In that, what might take place there might be very different than what we've decided to do today. I think we're looking at options, but I think what actually gets built might be slightly different. And hopefully, we leave UDOT to, in some regard, to be the professionals in this instance and find a good solution to us. But we've got to advocate as a community for what we need as well. And I think we're doing a good job of that.
Okay. All right. March 27th, I recall, is that comment deadline. Yeah. Wanted to ask about back on March 18th, you had rendered a decision on the elevation condominiums that developer Tyler wants to build on Red Pine Road. Neighbors sued the county over the council's decision to allow Tyler to build that driveway, saying it would increase traffic. So did you go ahead and approve those condos?
Yes, I was able to do that. I think the lawsuit has been filed, but we haven't been served papers yet as a county, and that they may be coming. And I know that Mr. Tyler and some of the HOA are actually in negotiations. I would, you know, it'd be great if they could work something out. They may or may not do that. But my legal counsel at the county said that we need to continue to to address the application that's before us, and we can't let that get in the way, the potential litigation get in the way of that. So most of the, I thought it was a good hearing. It was much longer than we had planned on having. Most of the comments were around access to Red Pine Road. That's been decided by the County Council. That's not what the hearing itself was about. It's related, of course, but I felt my obligation was to approve the application that was in front of me, and I did so, and I appreciated the comments and those who participated. It was very well attended, and some really probably valid points were made that day.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Shane?
Good luck to those that participate in convention today. That's going to be exciting to see how that goes. And we have a wealth of wonderful people who have decided to run for office, both locally and maybe even in the state. So.
Okay. Shane, thanks for your
Leslie,
time.
Leslie, thank you.
That's Summit County Manager Shane Scott. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:33. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, tomorrow, Park City teams are hosting a project open house from 3 to 4 p.m. at the Park City Council Chambers and via Zoom to provide information about the upcoming Main Street Waterline Improvement Project and the associated impacts. In the studio with a preview of that project set to begin next week, I have Historic Park City Alliance Executive Director Ginger Wicks on the phone with me. I have Park City Utilities Engineer Lloyd Griffin. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Lloyd, the project from Heber Avenue to 5th Street is still set to start Monday?
Correct. We'll get started April 1st, which is Monday. This is something that we've been in the works planning over the winter. We're looking at doing this in a three-phase approach over the next 3 years and trying to take advantage of the shoulder seasons of April to July.
Okay. So why the rush to do this project over the one that had been planned for years to redo Park Avenue?
So Park Avenue is still part of a bigger project that is slated with the city engineer's office and will include sewer, storm drain, sidewalk, and some reconstruction. We're still seeing that quite a few years out, and this one started seeing a lot of breaks over the last year. We actually seen 12 breaks just in this last year and two since the first of the new year. So this pipe has started to become a big problem with us and one of our highest priorities.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, it is going to be a three-year phased project. Will this summer, 2024, be the worst year, or should we just plan on just awfulness of the next 3 years?
This one has the most fire lines in it, this is the stretch that we've seen the most breaks in. So this is one of the bigger stretches from Heber to 5th. Next year will probably be 5th to 4th, and then 4th to the top of Main. So this is a little bit longer stretch with a few more fire lines in it.
Yeah, so given the fact that you're seeing more breaks in this area, is that why you're starting from the bottom up?
Some of that reason. We do lay usually from the bottom up, and this is also the higher pressure area of the pipeline, so we want to replace what we're seeing break the quickest.
Okay, and then why this configuration in terms of going from Heber to 4th? I mean, you could have gone shorter. I mean, why did it make sense to do it this way?
So we want to give the contractor as much room as we can in the limited amount of time that we have. So we want to give them the entire road. So in order to do the detour, we're going to switch the directions of 5th Street to allow people to go out around the detour. So, and then that gives us a good stretch to tackle and get done this year.
Okay, and that's the vehicle circulation is going to go cattywampus here. I mean, currently we, you know, from 5th Street near the post office, it's going to go the other direction than what we're used to today?
Correct. On Sunday night, we'll switch directions. So that one will switch as well as 4th Street will switch. So if you're coming downhill or northbound on Main Street, you'll turn at the post office to get onto Swede. And if you're coming uphill or southbound, you'll turn at Heber Avenue, be directed up Swede Alley, and you can either take 4th Street or the top of Main to access Main Street.
Okay. And I guess how will this impact then post office box holders? Are they going to have the same access they always have?
Same access as they always have. Parking configuration will change a little bit, but it's still the same access.
All right. And then in terms of trolley service, will that continue to run?
It will. It will just run out around the detour.
Okay. And then what about Main Street deliveries?
We are going to allow deliveries within the closure area, the delivery trucks. We've contacted a lot of the delivery services, and they'll just come to the barricades, and we'll allow them in and get them as close to the businesses as we can.
Okay. Ginger, what are Main Street business owners' biggest concerns about this?
Well, it obviously is a huge impact to people that are in the construction zone, and of course, I think their biggest concern is maintaining access to the businesses, and getting the message out that those businesses within that construction zone are open. And so the city is of course, going to make sure that access does maintain to all of the businesses during this time frame. We're working on some digital messaging to reinforce that as well, to try and continue to drive business up to Main Street during this time frame.
All right. So access to the rest, to the businesses, but
yes,
not parking in front of their streets.
Correct. Because, yeah, yes, because this section of the street during the day will be closed to traffic. They are going to open it back up to traffic at 7 o'clock each night, but you will not be able to park in that area at any time.
Okay. And that's what I did read, that the road will reopen to at least one lane of vehicle traffic in the evenings and the weekends. So will this be one-way traffic, and how will that flow?
That's a good question for Lloyd.
we plan on it being two-way traffic. We don't intend on it being one-way traffic, so that we don't have to flag it and don't have signals.
All right. So you'll just have what, a trench, one trench down the, like, the middle of the street, and then smaller ones that go into the businesses? Is that what you'll have to
correct
cover?
Okay. Correct. So to begin with, we'll do the main line work, and it'll work pretty fast. The main line will actually go fast, and I would assume a lot of people will think that we're moving very quickly, but the time-consuming portion of this work will be each individual fire line going into the buildings.
Okay, so those are kind of the lateral crossings, and that you'll be able just to cover those then with metal plates or something. Is that what you're...
Correct.
Yeah, okay. It sounds like that restaurants could also be facing water shutoffs. How's that going to be handled?
So any shutoffs, we don't anticipate being longer than 8 hours. We've been in contact with a few of the restaurants in the immediate area, and a few of them actually closed during this time frame. So we're trying to get a lot of their laterals installed before we impact them at all.
Okay. And if water does need to be turned off, they'll just have what, water storage, or?
So they'll be without water for no more than 6 to 8 hours, and we schedule those shutdowns at least 48 hours in advance. And then we also try and find them temporary water if it's easily available.
All right. But I'm just thinking maybe of the restrooms. I mean, it's one thing to cook with, you know, imported water, but, you know, what about the restrooms?
Yeah, and that's what the temporary water would be for, so that they can at least use their facilities.
Okay. So what concessions did you get from the city, Ginger, then, in terms of trying to, you know, relieve some of these impacts?
Well, the city worked with us, and we are starting actually on Monday as well. Parking in China Bridge will be free through the duration of the construction time frame. So from April 1st to July 1st, parking in China Bridge will be free. Of course, as impactful as this project sounds, I will say that the city started talking with us back in the fall that this was coming, and we've been working collaboratively on how to make sure we lessen the impacts to businesses, and the city is also working on some marketing elements to help also send out that message that businesses are open. I would say to all the businesses on Main Street, I really encourage you all to attend tomorrow's informative session, and also to make sure that I have your correct contact information. So if you're not sure you're getting our emails or there's more people on your staff that needs to be getting this information, please reach out to me and make sure that we have you on the list, because communication throughout this process is going to be critical, and it's going to make the impacts on your business less if you know what's going on. So please make sure we've got your contact information.
How do they get that to you?
You can email me at ginger@historicparkcityutah.com.
All right. Any idea how many parking spots are being lost as a result of this?
Oh, you know, I don't know that exact number. Griff, do you know the exact number in that area?
I don't. I think it was calculated right around 20.
Okay.
All right. But it sounds like the majority of traffic during the day will be up and down Sweet Alley then, huh?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Anything else you think people ought to know before Monday? Are you anticipating any weather delays? Because the weather's not looking great.
Not with this first stretch. With the excavation and the installation of water lines, weather doesn't affect us a whole lot. It's just when we start to get to the end and we're putting back hardscape that the weather starts to get impactful.
Okay. So the plan is that the July 4th parade will go on as planned.
Correct.
Okay. Ginger, anything else you wanted to add?
No, thanks for your time. And again, I just encourage everybody to attend tomorrow night so that they can be correctly informed, because I think, you know, the rumorville misinformation can get everybody riled up. And so make sure you've got the correct information.
Okay. We'll put that link in terms of how people can access the meeting via Zoom.
Excellent.
And our post later today.
Thank you.
Lloyd, Ginger, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:45. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. The Park City Community Foundation has unveiled the new name for two youth sport funds, which have been combined into one known as Youth United. In the studio with details, I have Park City Community Foundation Equity and Access Manager Jose Chacon and Vice President of Equity and Impact, Diego Zagara. Good morning.
Good morning.
Buenos días, Leslie.
Why the new name?
Jose? Yeah, why the new name? Is that we were really just, how this all kind of started was last year. I mean, we have two initiatives, particularly the Solomon Fund and the Rise Fund. The Solomon Fund really focused from K to eighth grade, and the Rise Fund really focused on Park City High School students, right? And we were just in conversations and really figured that, you know, let's merge these two together to really expand our scope, right? That all kids have access to sports and recreation activities from K to 12th grade. And we wanted a name, too, that really represented that as well, and bringing kids together. And that's how we came about, really, Youth United. It's just to create that impact, really have that name that represents the work that we are doing.
Okay, well, my experience is that the older a student gets, the more it costs. And I guess so, will the younger kids still get that, the same resources they had under the Solomon Fund?
Yes, exactly. And I mean, what is really great is just that since now we're here in one initiative that goes from K to 12th, we really could start with kids at a younger age, getting them access to sports and recreation at a low cost, and all the way up until high school now, where they have the experience and the financial aid that's there available for them to participate in sports.
Yeah, I guess my question, though, is there's going to be some bookkeeping involved, right, so that mm-hmm. you ensure that the monies that were coming in for Solomon Fund are going to where they were intended.
Yeah, no, in fact, with the race awareness, we're hoping to increase funding for all grades, both K through 8 and 8 through 12. Mm-hmm. So the one initiative, Youth United, it's going to keep its commitments to the younger grades as well as increase its commitments across the board. That's our goal for every kid that is looking to participate in the variety of activities our community offers, whether it's soccer classes, dance lessons, or skiing on this lovely snowy day, that we're able to make that happen.
Yeah. So combined, how much is the fund now?
You mean in cost?
Well, how much you have to distribute?
Roughly each year we're looking at about $300,000 in grants and scholarships. Mm-hmm. It looks a little different whether it's a nonprofit organization operating outside the school walls or an activity at the high school. But this year we're looking at a roughly $300,000 in support in scholarships.
All right. So the money is raised then through direct donations and grants then?
yeah, this community has showed up in a meaningful way. Yes, we look at our initial funders for each of the funds and how each initiative has grown. It made a lot of sense, given the scope of the work is so similar, mm-hmm. to call it one thing, Youth United. This community has shown up significantly and has allowed us to continue growing each year. The Solomon Fund was born in 2016, Rice Fund around 2020, 2021. And as we move forward, we're seeing continued raised awareness and support of those donors. So thank you to all of our supporters.
Yeah. Jose, how many youth are you helping with the funding?
Oh, man. I mean, I want to say hundreds of youth. Definitely. I want to say for last year, for example, we've probably helped around like close to 2,000 kids, particularly from the Latinx community. And so, it varies, but we want to say like hundreds and hundreds of kids. And I mean, just for example, Sunday we had one of our big registration events, and we had probably about like 200 people attend that event, you know, with Spanish volunteers to help out kids and so forth. And so it's a ton of kids.
Yeah, so the fund isn't specifically for the Latino community.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's where we see a lot of the need. But really, any kid that needs any financial assistance to access sports and recreation activities, we're there. But we particularly see the need in the Latino community.
Hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so what can the funding be used for? I mean, say, mm-hmm. you mentioned kind of dance programs. I mean, if somebody wanted to be part of a dance program, how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly, there's like three areas, I mean, usually funds are used for. One is obviously just reducing costs, having the initial cost of programs just be a lot lower, you know, rather than paying a ton of money. It's just a more accessible rate. So scholarships is one way that the funds are used. Another way that they're used is to do more outreach and communications. So finding ways to really make the process of signing up for programs a lot more easy. I mean, if you think about our Spanish-speaking communities, definitely can we get registration systems in Spanish, are able to do Spanish communication so that way families are aware. And the third and final piece is kind of cultural inclusion. And I like to kind of tell a short story of what I mean by cultural inclusion. So about a month ago, we had a family ski day on a Sunday where not only the kids, but families, and this was in collaboration with Park City Ski and Snowboard. So not only the kids, but the parents were able to ski alongside with them and get to learn as well. I mean, the kids were already pros, but the families and myself included, we were just like kind of falling, trying to learn. How to cross-country ski. And that's kind of one of the other things, too, is really creating more community connectiveness and, family events and so forth, just to create more engagement.
All right. So how would a parent then access the funding? So say they wanted to, again, register for high school soccer team, or maybe they wanted to register for the summer camp.
Absolutely. And the two look a little different. If you're applying for an activity, say, at the high school, the specific extracurricular activity will have an option to subsidize your participation in it so that it's only $40. Now, nonprofits operating outside of the school walls, we're offering grants to those organizations. There's a grant cycle that actually just closed a couple of weeks ago, and we will be disbursing $200,000 to these nonprofit organizations to bump up the level of scholarships they can offer and the number of kids that can access them.
Ah, okay. So money doesn't go directly to the parents or to the organization. It would be the child applying for a program and then that scholarship being offered to them.
Yes. We partner with 30 different local organizations, primarily nonprofit, but there's also other organizations out there. And a kid doesn't really know the difference between a nonprofit and a for-profit. They just want to do karate, for example. So our job is to make that happen. And we work with those organizations. We offer grants so that they can pass those on to their students in the form of scholarships.
All right. So what are some of the most popular programs that you see?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely soccer is one of the big things with Park City Soccer Club. Boxing with Rise Boxing. We have a collaboration with Ballet West, so some dance classes as well. Ice skating. Obviously, the winter sports is looking outside and seeing all this snow. That's always a popular one. Not too long ago, we did a program with Woodward where we had little kids, like 4 or 5 year olds, 5, 6 year olds participate and getting them on skis already early. And so definitely winter sports, soccer, boxing, you name it, we got it.
Yeah, and then how do you determine which organizations then to grant the money to? Is it based on input from participants?
Yeah, we have a committee of community members from different backgrounds helping us make the determinations on how to allocate those dollars. So organizations get to apply. Let's say Ballet West is one of our partners, or Park City Soccer Club, and the committee looks at the amount of dollars that we have and how an organization is working, what kind of scholarships they're offering, and how many kids they can take in. And we'll be making those determinations in the next 3 weeks or so.
Great. And then how often do you do the grant?
Once a year, mm-hmm. although every once in a while there's an ad hoc opportunity throughout the year. If there's a new organization entering the community, we would love to talk with them, and especially if they're looking to get more kids from diverse backgrounds, kids that are experiencing financial barriers. We'd love to sit down with them and talk about how to make that happen.
Yeah, so as a result of this funding that's been going on since, what would you say, 2016?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what have you seen as a result?
So some of the output, some of the numbers. When we first started working on this, we were seeing relatively low levels of participation by Latino students mm-hmm. in activities like that were happening outside the school walls, likely in the low single digits. Over time, our goal was for these activities to mirror the representation in the school district. So roughly 20% of the students identifying as Latino. We wanted to see a more complete community. We wanted to see belonging and inclusion happening. And that's what we've seen. By the numbers, we're looking at about 18-19% representation in the partners that we offer grants to. Last year, it was 22 of them. And it's incredibly promising as this has grown. And at the same time, Jose talked about cultural inclusion. Mm-hmm. What does it look like to belong? What does it look like to feel like you're part of a team? I ask folks, do you remember that first sport that you really loved that made you feel like you were part of a team? And that's what we're looking for here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to even emphasize that a little more, going back to the cross-country family day and so forth, that program a few years ago really didn't have a lot of Latino kids. And now we're seeing like close to around 30-ish kids participating in the program. And the family day is now like a yearly tradition. This year was like the third year doing this program. And that's even growing too as well, and seeing more parents on skis, which for me, that's exciting, you know, just to see families getting together and enjoying sports with their kids.
Yeah, and nobody left out.
No one left out.
Okay, anything else you want to tell us about the rebrand here?
Absolutely. Youth United, part of the Community Foundation, is still operating as a nonprofit, so we're always encouraging folks to connect with us and learn more about the work we do. If we are successful in our job, any kid in the Park City School District will have access to these amazing sports and rec opportunities.
Okay, and you're getting that word out to the Spanish-speaking community.
Absolutely, yeah. Our Facebook following, our Instagram page, we're got a newsletter all out there in communications as far as like social media and so forth, even WhatsApp. So we're out there spreading the word.
Okay. Jose, Diego, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Thank you.
The Heber City Council approved changes to the downtown core they hope will make it more business and visitor friendly. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has details.
The C3 zone is small but impactful. It stretches from 300 North to 300 South Main Street and from 100 East to 100 West. City leaders want it to be the center of downtown, but changes have been a long time coming, according to Council Member Mike Johnston.
I think we could debate this ad nauseum for months. I'm reticent to just keep trying to perfect it because I don't know if we're going to ever do that. I'm willing to move forward and adopt this tonight.
Last week, the council adopted changes that include new uses such as art spaces and hotels, establishing building and design standards, capping building heights to 3 stories or, in some cases, 4, and reducing parking requirements. Chain businesses, which Heber defines as businesses with more than 20 locations, will also be prohibited. City leaders also loosened parking requirements. New businesses will no longer have to provide on-site parking, and existing ones won't need to add parking if they expand. Heber leaders say they want this change to incentivize more investments in Main Street. Still, they acknowledge the city needs more parking, as community members have brought up throughout the C3 rezoning process. Councilmember Yvonne Barney says she wants to ensure people have access to parking when they visit Heber.
Especially those who have businesses in town, they cannot be having this concern about where their patrons will park.
The city plans to add dozens of surface parking spaces downtown in the coming years, with the possibility of building a garage if demand continues to grow. Council members voted unanimously to approve the updates to the C3 zone, while acknowledging they will continue to tweak the zone requirements. More information about the changes can be found on Heber City's website. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.